Well, welcome back to the God School. This is going to be the second reading of Dr. Gene Scott's Volume 5 on the series Jesus Christ, Supernut or Supernatural. It's only the first reading you're going to hear. I had completed this reading, Volume 5, earlier today, only to discover that the microphone wasn't turned on. I want you to understand, I'm a man the same as you who are listening. The same as those who were first called by Christ, full of foibles and troubles and sins, but nonetheless called by God and graced by God with a gift of faith, part of which is endurance. So we're going to go at it again. We're in Volume 5. Jesus Christ, Supernut or Supernatural by Dr. Gene Scott. The context in which he is presenting this question of Christ, Supernut or Supernatural, are his travels around the world. This particular volume is written on his travels in the country of Peru, and he tells of spending time with young people searching. And he writes, because we had spent time together and gained rapport on other subjects first, I left these young people with a fresh realization that limited views on Christianity might ought to be avoided with the same questioning probation as would be the case in other disciplines. I went to my room with mixed emotions. I had witnessed once again the probing intellect of today's young people. They really want to get it together. And they can spot a superficial picture so quickly when they do pay attention. In this foggy corner of Western South America, I found kids who wanted to grapple with issues of life and who were seriously studying a people and a culture. True, they were hunting life and its kicks, but they were also searching for life's deeper meanings and purposes. Yet, when the subject turned to Christianity, they seemed to turn it off as unworthy or incapable of serious and scholarly pursuit. That bugged me, as it has repeatedly in this series of studies, but I determined to press on in saying, look, the New Testament faith proclaimed an astounding thing. Jesus Christ, who made such far-out claims about himself as to require a supernatural quality, is also claimed to have risen from the dead. Man, if that could be true, then Jesus Christ is the most amazing thing ever happening to this old world of ours, whether the subject is flying through the clouds, freedom for a nation, or diagnosing a culture, you can form your opinions by a limited view, or you can really sort things out. The preaching of the resurrection is so central to the New Testament Christianity that it forces an explanation. And many theories have been propounded, as we have repeatedly indicated. On matters of religion, most of those theories are based on limited views of historic facts. An event as profound in its implication and as far-reaching in its influence as the Christian preaching of the resurrection deserves more than casual attention. But you can only get it all together by really sorting it out. Hence, the title of this volume. The next chapter focuses on this central fact of Christian origins and examines the theories which purport to explain its preachments. The explosive beginning of the New Testament church produced 3,000 converts on one day. The place was Jerusalem. The preacher was Peter. The audience was at first a mocking mob. The sermon proclaimed the resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ. Here are Peter's words. O men of Israel, listen! God publicly endorsed Jesus of Nazareth by doing tremendous miracles through him, as you well know. But God, following his prearranged plan, let you use the Roman government to nail him to the cross and murder him. Then God released him from the horrors of death and brought him back to life again, for death could not keep this man within its grips. And we all are witnesses that Jesus rose from the dead and now sits on the throne of the highest honor in heaven next to God. That's a Living Bible translation of Acts 2, 22-24 and verse 32. Years later, the Apostle Paul summarizes the essence of the New Testament message in a letter to the church at Corinth. I passed on to you right from the first what had been told me. And I would stop for a minute and say, that's what I'm doing here at the God School. Passing on that which had first been told to me, that Christ died for our sins just as the scriptures said he would, and that he was buried, and that 3 days afterwards he arose from the grave just as the prophets foretold. He was seen by Peter and later by the rest of the 12. After that, he was seen of more than above 500 Christian brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have died by now. Then James saw him, and later all the apostles. Also, Living Bible, 1 Corinthians 15, 1-7. Paul went on to say concerning Christ, if he is still dead, then all our preaching is useless. And your trust in God is empty, worthless, hopeless. And we apostles are all liars because we have said that God raised Christ from the grave. And you are foolish to keep on trusting God to save you. But the fact is that Christ did actually rise from the dead. Continue reading on in 1 Corinthians 15. These two statements are typical of the New Testament emphasis on the resurrection. It was on this asserted fact that the entire projection of New Testament faith in Christ's supernatural nature was based. In short, New Testament preachers based their entire case on the claim of the resurrection, and as has been pointed out in volume 4 of this series, the significance of the resurrection is astounding because of the person about who this claim was made. It was Jesus of Nazareth, the man who claimed perfection, who seated all authority in himself, who asserted a previous and eternal existence for himself, who made himself the center of the religious universe by demanding total allegiance to himself as a person, who maintained that his death would somehow redeem the whole world, and who claimed that after death he would resurrect from the dead. This is the man about whom the resurrection fact was being asserted. By this resurrection, if true, all of Jesus' other claims gain credence, and his supernatural quality is given basis. Without the resurrection, Jesus could be dismissed as a super nut or a convincing, super fake. Since this continues to be, in part, a chronicle of my own personal return to faith, let me say that settling this issue of the truth or falsity of the resurrection became a personal obsession with me. As I delved into the records relating to this New Testament preaching of the resurrection, one thing became obvious. To settle this fact of the resurrection, certain other things must first be taken for granted. As with any other ordered discipline, disciplined discussion, one must presuppose certain other things at the same time. For example, to discuss the Civil War in the United States, one presupposes that a United States exists or existed, and that a certain conflict called the Civil War occurred. Otherwise, why discuss the causes? The same is true of the matter before us. I found that reasonable discussion of the resurrection would presuppose these other items. 1. Jesus lived. Even the heathen historian Tacitus affirms this fact, yet one still can find those who try to deny that Jesus even existed as an historic person. That isn't too shocking. One cannot even prove to everyone's satisfaction that one's own self exists. In fact, we just assume that fact to be true, act on the premise, and rather enjoy the experience. It cannot be proven, however. It is assumed, and facts offered in its support seem convincing to those who take the trouble to look in the areas where we express ourselves. One cannot, therefore, expect everyone to believe that Jesus existed. Those who look, however, seldom debate the fact anymore. To argue about his resurrection without first settling the fact of Christ's existence is nonsense. One assumes he lived in order to discuss whether or not he was raised from the dead. Number two, Jesus was crucified by the hands of Roman authorities at the instigation of the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem. Again, this fact is presupposed, undergirding the record, and it must be taken for granted prior to a discussion of New Testament beliefs about the resurrection. More to the point, it would be easier to demonstrate to those who argue about the resurrection that Jesus' crucifixion occurred, that it was an occurrence ordered by Roman authorities, instigated by Jewish religious leaders, than it would be to demonstrate that Jesus also rose from the dead. If one disbelieves this premise number two, then discussion should concentrate on this item, which is far easier to prove than to demonstrate the resurrection event. It may be of interest to the reader to note that a Jewish legal scholar in recent years has tried to reopen the trial of Jesus in modern Israeli courts, but has been turned down by the Israeli Supreme Court. His assertion is that a possible miscarriage of justice needed to be re-examined. The Jewish High Court insists that the matter belongs in Rome, since it was a Roman court that delivered the verdict. Number three, Jesus was considered dead. Note that I haven't said he was dead, but he was considered dead. Again, no sense can be had in discussing the resurrection from the dead if you do not believe he died, or at least was considered dead. It is much easier to satisfy a critic that Jesus was considered dead than it is to convince him that Jesus rose from the dead. The point is that when one does not believe Jesus was considered dead, it is far better to restrict the discussion to settling that fact. You engage in meaningless rhetoric if he is not even believed to be considered dead. Number four, Jesus was buried in a known and accessible tomb at Jerusalem. In the modern world, there is controversy concerning alternate locations for this so-called tomb of Christ, but I know of no serious attempt in history to assert that Jesus was buried in an unknown tomb at the time of his burial. All the records on the subject agree that the location of his tomb was known and available to be found by those living in the city at the time of his death. In spite of the repetition, may I say again that this fact would be more easy to demonstrate if questioned rather than the controversial issue of the resurrection. And it should be tackled, if questioned, prior to any meaningful discussion of the resurrection. Number five, Jesus was preached and proclaimed, raised from the dead, ascended into the heavens, and that the tomb was empty. The nature of this message, including the assumption of the empty tomb, gives substance to premise number four above, that Jesus was buried in a known, accessible tomb. The hearers of the first message were urged to go and to see an empty tomb. The nature of this preaching, which asserts the resurrection and ascension, is illustrated in the opening paragraphs of this chapter. In addition, the reader should examine Matthew. Write this down if you want to. My words. The reader should examine Matthew chapter 27, beginning with verse 57 and continuing through chapter 28. Luke chapter 23, beginning verse 50 through chapter 24. John's Gospel chapter 19, beginning verse 38 and continuing through chapters 20 and 21. And Acts chapter 1, verse 1 through 11. It is important to notice that the New Testament Christians preached, proclaimed, and believed a total message. The organic whole of which included not just the resurrection, but also the seen appearances of Christ after the resurrection, the ascension, and the fact of the empty tomb. To be aggressively redundant, I must once again say that the fact of this preached message by New Testament Christians is easier to demonstrate than the resurrection event itself. Number six, the Jewish leaders at Jerusalem were more concerned, thus more motivated, to disprove the preaching of Jesus' resurrection than any reader or scholar would be today. We're 1900 years removed from the issue. They were vitally involved in the outcomes at the time. This premise is demonstrated by logical deduction and common sense. Fact two above presumes that the Jewish leaders, through their accusations and charges against Jesus, caused his crucifixion. Now, if what was being preached about the resurrection from the dead were true, think what this did to their reputation as religious leaders. Indeed, an early record has the high priest asking New Testament preachers, saying, concerning their preaching about Jesus and his resurrection from the dead, did not we straitly command you that ye should not teach in this name? And behold, you filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. That's Acts 5, verse 28. The religious reputation of these Jewish leaders must be maintained. Upon its continuance depended their economic livelihood and possibly even their very lives. If Jesus were raised from the dead, their authority over the people and judgment as religious leaders, their position and maybe their lives were at stake. In short, disproving the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead was a matter of bread, butter, and blood. To them, hence, they would be more motivated to look into the matter with greater degree of intensity than you and I, who consider the subject via this volume or as distant students. Number seven, the earliest disciples and apostles received terrible persecution of preaching this message excuse me, let me start over. Number 7. The earliest disciples and apostles received terrible persecution because of preaching this message about Christ. The first apostles proclaimed Christ's resurrection and ascension as proof of his divinity. This caused their first persecutions. I realize that in later years, Christians became scapegoats for society and oftentimes received persecution because of their identity as a community, or as ready victims to blame for various illnesses besetting the Roman Empire. However, all the records are clear that initial persecution of the earliest apostles was because of their claims about Christ, his resurrection, and his ascension. Again, please examine closely the New Testament records of their sermons included in the opening portions of this chapter. It is further true that all these early apostles had to do in order to cause their persecution to cease was to recant their claims about Christ's resurrection and ascension, and abstain from preaching such assertions. Number 8. The tomb in which Christ was buried is empty. This fact is demonstrated first by logical deduction. Assume our premise number 3 above, that Jesus was buried in a known accessible tomb. Assume still further our premise number 6 above about the vital concern of the Jewish leaders to disprove all preaching about the resurrection. It then follows that such a concern would have taken those same leaders to the easily located tomb to discover if it was truly empty. If a body had been found in the tomb, it would have been a simple matter for the Jewish leaders to produce said body. They could not do it because the tomb was empty. One of the earliest records has these same leaders accusing the disciples of stealing the body in order to give explanation for an empty tomb. A second indication of its emptiness is the fact that to this day, no one can prove for certain which of alternative sites is the true location of Jesus' tomb. Yet, in that same land, other teachers and leaders of men have tombs revered and located dating from centuries prior to Christ. Why was this man Jesus, dearly beloved by many of his followers, buried in a tomb which has been lost in the historic record, a tomb that no one can locate for certain, even though early records indicate that, true to custom, those who loved him went to his tomb after his death? Only one thing explains it. There was nobody in it, so no one bothered to remember it. New Testament Christians worshipped a resurrected Christ and had no further interest in the tomb. Only in later years, as Christians began to give emphasis to artifacts and holy sites, have men began to concern themselves with finding Christ's tomb. But by that time, the tomb was lost. And I suppose the date over the true site of Christ's tomb will continue for many years to come. As indicated many times, all of the facts mentioned above are much easier to demonstrate than proving that Christ was raised from the dead. Because they are easier, they should be demonstrated before an attack on the resurrection. If they cannot be taken for granted, then a discussion of the resurrection is not very meaningful. Because they are easier facts to demonstrate, this volume does take them for granted, assumes them to be true, and then proceeds to discuss the resurrection in that frame of reference and on that basis. And in this little book I'm reading from, Dr. Scott has added an asterisk wherein he writes, "The author had to settle each of these facts one by one for himself. Any other searching student may have to do the same. Just let me repeat, these eight facts are much easier to settle than the resurrection itself. On that basis, they are assumed to be true in this volume and taken for granted in the discussion of the resurrection, which is more critical and finally the proving point." Back to the text. Many theories have been offered to explain the vigor with which the New Testament preaching of the resurrection survived. Other theories have been offered to give explanation as to why such a claim of the resurrection was presented at all. The major ones of these alternative theories are listed below. However, if the above eight facts are taken for granted, and they are in this discussion, then only two possible theories can be allowed to explain the New Testament preaching of the resurrection. I will first name the eight most prominent theories and then show why only two of the eight are allowed by the facts. Number one, the disciples stole the body from the tomb and then began to preach that he had raised from the dead. Number two, Jewish leaders took the body from the tomb and the disciples, discovering an empty tomb, began to preach the resurrection. Number three, the Roman authorities took the body from the tomb, and the disciples, discovering an empty tomb, began preaching the resurrection. Number four, the women who first reported the resurrection went to the wrong tomb. In the early morning light, they got lost and went to an empty tomb and honestly reported an empty tomb, but they were in the wrong tomb. Because of this error, the disciples mistakenly began to preach the resurrection. Number five, Jesus wasn't really dead. He was considered dead, but in the coolness of the tomb, resuscitated and came forth. It wasn't therefore a true statement in spite of what the disciples preached, but a recovery from a near death. Number six, the disciples had hallucinations. They thought they saw all they preached about, including the resurrection, but it didn't really happen. Number seven, the disciples made up the whole story to save face. They were telling lies, and they knew they were telling lies. At number 8, the disciples were honestly reporting what they saw, and exactly as they saw and experienced the things told. The facts are that there are only 2 of these theories that are tenable. The disciples were either lying and knew it, theory number 7, or they were honestly reporting fact as they saw and experienced it, theory number 8. Let's take a look at them one by one. Theory number 1, if the disciples stole the body, then they were lying, and that leaves us with theory number 7. Theory number 2 is untenable when you consider fact number 6 in the list of 8 facts named above. Fact number 6 pointed out the concern of the Jewish leaders to disprove the preaching of the resurrection. If the Jewish leaders had taken the body, all they had to do was say so, and all the problems associated with the apostles' preaching would come to an end. Even if this theory were tenable to explain the empty tomb, it would not explain the apostles' testimony about eyewitness accounts of Christ's appearance, messages, and ascension. The disciples' preaching added these additional elements, which would represent fabrication if theory 2 were taken for granted. This then leaves theory number 7 again. They would be lying. Theory number 3 is untenable on the same basis. The Jewish leaders' relationships with Roman authorities, coupled with their concern to disprove resurrection preaching, would easily have produced certification by Roman authorities that the Roman government had indeed removed the body. Again, if theory number 3 is tenable, it only explains the empty tomb. The disciples would once more be guilty of fabricating the additional part of their message related to appearances and ascension. This reduces down again to theory number 7, and the disciples lied. Theory number 4 is untenable on its face. If the women went to the wrong tomb, all that was required for one to silence all the preaching was to point out the right tomb. Our facts have assumed, fact number 4, that the tomb was known, accessible, and fact number 6, that the concern of the Jewish leaders would have taken them to the right location. Theory number 5 is equally untenable on its face. You just do not resuscitate from a Roman crucifixion. The disciples did not preach a shroud-wrapped, emaciated, recovered from near-death Christ. Further, this theory does not explain the kind of reports they gave of Christ's appearance and ascension. They, therefore, would have had to fabricate the balance of their testimony, and we are driven to theory number 7 again. The disciples lied. Theory number 6 appears most tenable of all to the casual observer. A closer look at the facts, however, explodes the hallucination theory. In the first place, psychiatric evidence indicates that a certain pre-positioning of the mind is necessary for one to have hallucinations. Excuse me. All of the records available about the disciples indicate that they were each and all in frames of mind exactly the opposite to that which would bring on such hallucinations. Furthermore, if only hallucinations were involved, and thus psychological honesty would be credited to the disciples, then the body would still be in the tomb. The fact of Jewish leaders' concern and the accessibility of Jesus' tomb made the hallucination theory easy to shatter. You may be sure that the Jewish leaders would have looked in the tomb and produced a body to shatter the preacher's hallucinations. There was no body there, as we have indicated. To believe the statistical probability that the body would both disappear and all the New Testament preachers would have hallucinations stretches the imagination beyond normal belief. Dr. Scott invites the reader to examine Frank Morrison's Who Moved the Stone and Wilbur Smith's Therefore Stand for lucid and adequate explanation of the difficulties in assuming the hallucination theory. The fact is that the hallucination theory is made untenable by the empty tomb. In short, when a disciplined look at the facts as they exist is taken, the disciples were either lying and knew it, or they were honest and truthful men reporting the facts as they experienced them. Thus, the fundamental issue of the resurrection boils down to the veracity of the reporters. If the disciples were dishonest men fabricating a story, however clever it may be, they deserve no respect. The other alternative is that these were honest men who reported on the most astounding fact of history. When this inevitable dichotomy closed in upon me in my experience, I had to settle the question myself. Were these men lying? Were they liars and knew it? Or could I satisfy myself that I was confronting honest men giving honest reports? I settled the issue and became convinced, after 3.5 years of hard study, that these were honest men giving honest reports of the astonishing happening of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Why and how I became convinced of this fact is the subject of Volume 6 in this series. Which shall follow shortly. I hope you're getting into this as much as I am. And we'll take the time to listen to this discussion on the facts of the resurrection. Together and in sequence. It's the basis of our Christian faith, ladies and gentlemen. And therefore, I will be eternally grateful, am eternally grateful to Dr. Gene Scott for making it available to men and women like you and me. And that's the God School for today.